Nan O'Nagle was born in Cork in 1718 as the founder of the Sisters of the Presentation of the Blessed Virgin Mary. She was a pioneer of Catholic education in Ireland, but hers was a global vision, as she wrote to a friend in 1769.
My schools are beginning to be of service to a great many parts of the world. If I could be of service in saving souls in any part of the globe, I would be willing to do all in my power.
And as we'll hear, those are words that would prove quite prophetic for Nan O'Nagle, as the order she founded would spread around the world. And that quote demonstrates the outward-looking vision she had, a vision which was exceptional for a Cork woman in the 1780s. I'm joined now by Deirdre Raftery, historian of education at University College Dublin, who, along with Katrina Delaney and Catherine Nolan Roebuck, is the author of the recently published book Nan O'Nagle, The Life and Legacy. You're very welcome to the History Show. The name, first of all, Nano. Where does Nano come from?
A pet name that her parents put on her, a little pet name deriving from her first name, Honora.
She was Honora Nagle. And you were telling me during the break, Honora was a common enough name
in Ireland, yes, at that time, for girls.
And certainly has disappeared without trace, more or less. I'm sure we will get texts in from millions of Honoras giving the lie to that. She came from a prosperous family, and that's very, very important to this story.
Yes, she did. The Nagles were wealthy. They were landowners. They were also land leasers. And they were very well known in Munster. They lived all along the Blackwater Valley, and that was where she was born. Much of their wealth would have derived from the letting of land and also from orcharding. They were big apple growers, and they made quite a substantial fortune out of that.
So you're basically saying to me that Nan O'Nagle's fortune, Nan O'Nagle's money came from cider.
Well,
a lot of it.
Certainly their apples were exported for the cider business. Yes.
Now, although they were wealthy, they were Catholic, so that would not necessarily have protected them from the dangers of living in penal law Ireland.
Yes, I think that's true. It was certainly probably more true for Nan herself as a woman, as a young girl, than some of her uncles, for example. The male members of her family lived a lot of the time out of the country. They lived in Flanders. Some of them lived in Paris. And that was a way of protecting themselves and also protecting their financial interests. So she was more, I suppose, acutely aware of the dangers when she started to found her first schools in Cork, the dangers of attracting attention to herself as a Catholic woman who was trying to provide education for the poor, who should not have been going to schools at all.
And part of her money, I'm fascinated by how some of that money came to her, because it came as a consequence of one of her uncles choosing to die intestate, so without leaving a will.
Yes.
How did that work, and what was that all about?
It was a practice that was commonly used by Catholics who were not allowed under legislation to leave a will, leaving their wealth to their offspring or to their relatives. And they would leave their wealth in a trust, and the trustees who managed the estate would devolve the wealth as had been requested of them. And it was requested by her uncle, who died intestate, who was also quite wealthy, that his fortune, a considerable amount of it, would go to his niece, Nano. And that was what, as they would say nowadays, kind of leveraged the whole business for her. She then goes into the world of property and development, as we would now call it. But in fact, that's what she was doing. She started to build.
We'll come back to that in a few moments, but I want to talk about her education, because she was educated in France. Was that common for wealthy Catholics at the time to send their children to the continent, and how did it work, and how long would they have stayed there?
It would have been common for certainly Catholics of the social class that the Nagles belonged to. It would have been common to slip your sons and daughters out of the country.
Slip being the operative word.
Yes, you were not going to do this publicly, but you would want them to have an education, a scholarly education for your sons. To do this for your daughters was a little more unusual, not extremely unusual, but it would be very easy with daughters to educate them at home with a governess. But to give your son a classical education, you would have sent him to Spain or France, for example, to eventually to some of the Irish colleges. For Nano, and for her sisters, it would have not been unusual to just have a tutor. Yeah. So her parents made a very clear decision that they would send her out of the country with her sister to school. And she was probably away at school for 3 or 4 years at one stretch. And
so this wasn't like an Erasmus scholarship.
It
this
certainly
was
wasn't.
For the duration.
No, and she would have been young. So parents at that point, when they said goodbye to the child and sent the child away to school, even if they were going somewhere as close as, we'll say, the Bar Convent in York, you were still saying goodbye to the child for 3 or 4 years or maybe even longer.
And the alternative, I mean, one alternative obviously was tutoring at home, but if they were sent to schools,
yes,
there was presumably a risk of being proselytised.
Well, there would have been no question that a family like the Nagels would have sent their daughters to a day school or a Protestant school at that time in the country. There were charter schools and charity schools that were operating that would have educated the daughters of the poor, including the Catholic poor, who would have been proselytised. But for a family like the Nagels, it would have been a Catholic tutor or nothing. Mm. But you would be educated by your mother.
So she comes back to Ireland in 1746. Mm. And does she begin working in education? Does she begin working with the poor almost immediately? Mm.
Her life takes a few turns when she comes back firstly. She's in Dublin for a while. Her mother and her sister die. She was very close to one of her sisters and this sister dies. She then goes, as a lot of single women at the time would have had to do, to live with one of her brothers in Cork. So she's back in Cork. And she is influenced by servants on her brother's estate whose children are not educated, Catholic servants. And she is influenced at that point to try to set up poor schools. And she does that surreptitiously at first. Then there is another phase of her life. Again, the records of this are very scant, where she goes back to France and spends time in France and probably made her novitiate, as it would have been called, probably was considering entering a religious congregation herself, but in fact did not do that.
Yeah, that's one of the very interesting things about her.
It
again, we'll maybe talk about that a little bit later. But what she does do, one of the things she does, is she brings a group of nuns from Paris to Ireland.
Yes,
the Ursuline nuns.
She brings the Ursulines, and that is an extraordinary innovation. That's a major step to establish the Ursulines here in 1771. We are finally having a Catholic congregation back in the country that will run a school for girls, schools for girls.
Are the penal laws beginning to peter out at
this
stage?
Yes, absolutely. There would have been a relaxation. But we can gather from the way she talks about the job of building that convent that she did it quite secretively. And she writes to some of the other sisters, we cannot do exactly as we please in this country. So I think myself, to some degree, she was aware that as a woman, a single woman of her age, to be working so independently, supervising the builders, as she was, supervising the construction, making decisions about what this convent would look like. I think there was a gendered question here for Nan O'Nagle.
But also the Ursulines worked out to some extent, but not entirely, because they were in enclosed order.
Yes. Now, she would have known this. I don't think perhaps she realised the extent to which their rule of enclosure would impact on what she wanted to do. She wanted sisters who could be out among the poor. She had seen this in Paris. Walking nuns, as they were often called, who would be out among the poor. And the rule of enclosure that the Ursulines had would not allow this. They were running a poor school in their compound, as it were.
But the poor had to come to them.
Yes, but she wanted to be out because she realised you needed to actually find the children.
And that's where the Sisters of the Presentation come from.
That's where her impetus for that comes from. Very quickly, after spending between £3,000 and £4,000 of her fortune building the Ursuline Convent, she starts all over again.
And the mission, very clearly, of the Presentation Order of Nuns, as far as Nan O'Nagle was concerned, was focusing on the education of the poor. Not the middle classes, not the wealthy, it's very specifically the poor. Does she at any point during her own lifetime resile from that?
That was her absolute mission, and that's what she was very clear about. And that was the purpose and function and, of the congregation always. That is how it identified itself. Different parts of its mission across time, particularly in the 19th century when they went out, presentations went out of the country, their rules and regulations and ways of running convents had to change and had to modify. But from Nano's perspective, they were a congregation for the poorest of the poor.
She strikes me as a woman who had no intention of ever kowtowing to anybody. We've already addressed the fact she doesn't actually take vows as a nun herself until almost the end of her life.
She's not going
to kowtow to a mother superior or whatever. But also, she rubs up against Catholic bishops in Cork, one Catholic bishop.
There are a number of incidents in the small quantity of records of her life. There are a number of times when she rubs up against the hierarchy. She rubs up against Dr. Butler, the Catholic Bishop of Cork, at one point when he says, when she's building her Ursuline Convent, would you consider courting the approval of the Protestant ascendancy? And she refuses absolutely. When Dr. Moylan asks her to reconsider this idea of starting a convent for the poor, no question. She said, I'll take my wealth elsewhere.
She died in 1784. She had been in delicate health, but I think she suffered from tuberculosis. But she spent quite a while in remission, didn't she?
She did. She had a long remission. We know from her letters that she was coughing blood at an early stage. But she clearly had a long remission, which is perfectly medically possible. And then her consumption, we have evidence that her consumption was what killed her later in her life. She would have been among children that would have been tubercular, and among other sisters, many sisters in convents, many people were tubercular, and she would have been quite easily exposed to TB.
After her death, then, the presentation order begins to spread worldwide to some rather uncomfortable places, like Newfoundland, for example, and the Dakotas, North and South Dakota in the USA. Not particularly hospitable places.
No, their first mission out of the country, 1833, very early, they go to Newfoundland at the request of a bishop, Bishop Fleming, who comes to Ireland questing for vocations, as they used to call it. And he arrives up at the convent door in Galway and persuades some of their strongest and most useful sisters to go back with him on board a ship for that horrendous ship journey the whole way to Newfoundland. They're at sea for almost a couple of months, by which time it actually was assumed back in Ireland that the ship had been lost, because many months pass and no letter is ever received to say that they've arrived. And as was the custom of the time, the sisters in Galway burned their vows and had a requiem mass for the women who had left for Newfoundland.
Given them up for dead.
And then suddenly a letter finally arrived to say that they were there and they were surviving, but it was pretty inhospitable.
They went to hospitable. I note, for example, that they were in San Francisco in 1854. Yes. San Francisco in 1854 was a pretty roisterous, boisterous kind of place, not the safest place in the world for any female to be.
Sure. Another very difficult mission. In fact, many of that pioneering group that went to San Francisco left. They came back. They were not able for it. But the mother foundress out there was able for it. She held her ground and seemed to have been well able to stand up to both the conditions she was working in and the people she had to work with, and made a great success of that mission. But it was another very difficult one.
One of many, but if you want to find out about some of the other places that they went to, you can read the book, which is called Nano Nagel, The Life and the Legacy. And the legacy part is particularly important. Deirdre, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
For joining us. The book is by Deirdre Raftery, Katrina Delaney and Catherine Nolan Roebuck, and it's published by Irish Academic Press.